call the House Committee on Rules to order. Let the record show that a quorum is present, although we're a little bit thinner than usual today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I can guarantee that this is the best committee that meets at the 3 o'clock time slot anywhere in the building. So on the agenda, for folks in the audience, on the agenda today, we have four bills, and we have slated first House Bill 2092 and then House Bill 2920. We're going to flip the order of that. Representative Nathanson, who's who was here to speak on behalf and to carry House Bill 2920, is here, and so we'd like to move that up in the agenda. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2920. And, Jerry.
Thank you, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. House Bill 2920 creates a task force on effective and cost-efficient service provision. It establishes criteria for membership, a process for appointing members, and operating procedures of the task force. Directs the task force to review opportunities to provide services in the most effective and cost-efficient manner and to consider use of intergovernmental agreements to achieve cost savings. Requires the task force to analyze service areas in areas of assessment and taxation, elections, human services, public health, and criminal justice. And requires the task force to submit a report, possibly including recommendations for legislation, to the Interim Legislative Committee dealing with revenue by October 1, 2010. Proponents assert that it is particularly appropriate to examine how state and local governments can operate more efficiently and effectively during a period of economic downturn, limited revenues, and high demand for government services. I believe in your packet of materials you also have a proposed amendment and a hand-engrossed copy of House Bill 2920 that reflects those amendments.
Thank you. And Representative Nathanson, would you kick us off, please?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative, District 13. That's North Eugene. The economic crisis facing Oregon and its 36 counties isn't a matter of cash flow. We're in a deep, serious crisis now, and it's expected to last for a while. There is probably not a feasible way to raise enough new revenue to solve our budget gaps. And even if the federal timber payment problem didn't exist, we would still have a fundamental problem in how we're delivering services and the cost of delivering them. We have an economically unsustainable program of delivering services. The solution will not come from simply asking states and counties to consider raising additional revenue. While we may need to consider revenue restructuring, we also need to consider government restructuring. I believe now is the time. Our system of delivering services, policing, jails, ensuring clean water, protecting children, taking care of seniors and disabled persons, processing claims and complaints, it's complex. It's tangled enough that, for example, here in this building, it can take three or more legislative fiscal analysts to comb through various budgets of multiple agencies that report to different subcommittees of Ways and Means just to answer a question: what we spend to take care of those children, what we spend to treat persons with addictions and mental health problems, what we spend to tackle invasive species or to train workers. Then add to that 36 separate counties, and it gets really bollocksed up. In addition to discussing this with colleagues here at the Capitol, I've also paid close attention to information being developed by the Association of Oregon Counties and also the Governor's Task Force on Federal Forest Payments and County Services. My emphasis and county services. The final report of that task force, which looks like this, a lot of pages, it lists 53 specific recommendations. I was struck by the number of those recommendations on this report, which is about county services, have to do with state services or state support. Here's a short sample. Recommendations number 4 and 5 are about state police responsibility and medical examiners. Number 6, state support for wildlife services and animal damage control. Recommendations to increase state general fund support for prosecution. Add to the state's Criminal Justice Commission a staff person to assist counties with writing grants. Another recommendation on regionalizing community and close custody beds for the Youth Authority. Technical assistance to counties interested in creating regional jails, streamlining DHS, increasing state funding to counties, allowing co-location of Department of Transportation maintenance facilities with county facilities, state staffing for water management, and state picking up the cost of elections for statewide offices. At least 17 of the 53 recommendations in here explicitly call for increased state support, either funding or providing the service. So you get the idea. This report is full of statements that relate to the division of responsibilities between state and county government, as well as funding. Another series of reminders about our problem came just a couple of weeks ago in a joint Ways and Means Public Safety and Human Services hearing, actually hearings over two different evenings. One section of invited testimony presented a report called Analysis of Oregon's Alcohol and Drug Treatment and Prevention System. We heard about one issue of multiple state agencies involved, where it was described to us that there are differences in data systems, duplicate data entry, and subsequent burdens on providers, and multiply that within the layer that the county puts on it, all 36 counties. In another testimony from a Baker City service provider, we heard that we should allow a region the flexibility to manage the money to meet the needs. Right now, the money comes from the state to the 36 separate counties. It doesn't work in every part of the state to go through each separate county. This person was asking for or suggesting regionalization. Reviewing the information chart that Association of Oregon Counties prepares and provides for us, I scanned the chart, which illustrates services in 5 broad areas. Health and Human Services has 18 services. Public Safety, 20. Natural Resources and Recreation, 14 separate services. Transportation, Land Use, and Economic Development, 14 services. Other Community Services is another 18. Of those 79 separate services, 14 are provided by the state. 19 are provided by counties. And 46 of the 79 are shared by the state and county. From another angle, we have shared revenue agreements in a number of areas, including cigarette tax, liquor receipts, beer and wine taxes, video lottery, gambling, addiction treatment, county forest trust lands, gas tax and motor vehicle fees, property assessment and taxation, and recreational vehicle fees. Our bureaucracy is in the way. Our bureaucracy is pulling us down. And let's face it, there are tensions between the state and counties. Funding promises have either not been realized or funding agreements have been changed. Delivery of services may not meet expectations by one party or the other. And while the population has shifted, transportation and communication systems have evolved, and the underlying economy has changed, the underlying government structure has remained largely unchanged. Technology, in particular, now creates opportunities for increased efficiency. I've spent a lot of time so far describing the situation as a legislator and a bureaucrat, but I want to look at this very quickly from the point of view of the taxpayer or the voter and the service provider. Voters or taxpayers often care little about who's responsible. They just want someone to be responsible and get the job done. It's all tax money, and it's very little consolation for them to hear it's the other place that you need to talk to. From the point of view of the service provider, the burden of our bureaucracy is tremendous. I want to give you 2 examples that I think prove the point from the other side of the coin. The first example is from a Portland area child and family service provider. They have 46 contracts with 4 state agencies and 5 counties. Each has a completely separate clinical and fiscal compliance audit. This organization is involved in some kind of audit every day of the year, either preparing for an audit, responding to the audit, or training and implementing new policies as a result of audits and administrative rules. They have two full-time and one part-time dedicated staff just to respond to redundant oversight. The staff are in Human Resources, the Fiscal Department, and Quality Assurance. The other example I want to tell you about comes from a youth service provider in Southern Oregon that has contracts with Department of Human Services and Oregon Youth Authority. Both agencies audit the program for essentially the same services under comparable contracts and the same reimbursement rate. Quote, DHS wants details on shift staff hours each day for July and August 2008. I understand this is to confirm staffing ratios. OIA, on the other hand, was satisfied with 2 days that they picked randomly from June. OIA also wanted total staff hours for June, and that was easy to report. Then DHS wants personnel qualifications for all staff. OIA wanted the same information, but DHS wants the information in a different format. The bottom line, this is money going to redundant bureaucracy, not to delivering services to children and families. We have 36 separate elections divisions in each county working to maintain the integrity of voter registration and elections. We also have a Secretary of State that now has a statewide database of registered voters and services for managing elections. We have 36 separate assessment and taxation operations in the counties and a State Department of Revenue that is doing some of the same work. Again, with modern technology, communications, geographic and other data, what are we doing built on a 20th century platform that should be rebuilt now for the 21st century? In 2008, several other states were working on government reorganization and efficiency: New Jersey, New York, Maine, Ohio, Indiana, and Pennsylvania. The legislation shows that they all asked for local governments, cities and counties, to increase efficiency and effectiveness. I am not modeling my suggestion on any of those commissions because I think we, state and county government, are in this together. And together we need to figure out how to achieve the most effective delivery of services. One state does, however, use a technique that I've mentioned in a couple of previous bills I've drafted, which is offering incentive grants to help local governments with collaboration and cost saving. Another, Maine, has been working since 2003 on consolidating public safety, or 911, answering points, consolidating from 48 to around 20. And last year, they passed legislation to create a unified prison system for state and counties. So what should we do here in Oregon? I think we should take a fresh look at our division of delivering services. In the 1990s, the Oregon legislature developed the mechanism for intergovernmental agreements. Now, in the 2000s, let's take another step. Let's look at simplification, regionalization, consolidation, and reorganization with an emphasis on saving money and improving service. We should consider a redistribution of functions of state and county government, achieve clarification and rationalization of what we have now, and accomplish a transfer of functions where it makes sense. There's too much redundant auditing and not necessarily better outcomes. Too much accounting, but a lack of accountability. In the 1980s, at the urging of counties, welfare functions or public assistance was transferred from county to state government. Because of financial stress, now we already have a couple of counties that have opted out of local control for community corrections, and they've turned that over to the state. How many more counties will be handing over community corrections, public health, or other county services to the state as the months go by? Things are not okay as they are. What was right at one point in time may no longer be optimal at this point in time. I believe it's our job to periodically re-examine previous decisions. Parts of the system can get tangled and hard to manage. There is interest from legislators and other elected officials, and I believe there would be broad public support for this kind of a new review. It's important to take a step back and look at the whole picture from time to time, and I think that time has to be now. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. And before we move on to the next piece of testimony, I'd just like to thank you for bringing this forward. Obviously, I'm supportive. I'm a co-sponsor of the measure. I think this is overdue, this type of an effort. I was thinking as you were talking, it seems to me as that each, whether it's a governing body or each mechanism that's in place or structure or stricture, probably made sense to somebody at the time. But through an ongoing evolution, we've been left with a system that, as you've articulately explained to us or illustrated to us, doesn't always work well. And I think it's only during times of perhaps economic crisis, like we're in right now, that we can call the question, so to speak, on this issue. And it seems to me that, I mean, I think you're on to something important. And it seems to me that the longer folks work in the system, whether it's at the county level or at the state level, in the bureaucracy at the county and the bureaucracy at the state, the more accepting people become of that. And I want to thank you for bringing this forward. And I'm going to tell you what some of my constituents told me when I first got elected, and that's don't let them change you. Keep fighting the good fight. And pushing forward on these type of things, and I certainly hope that these type of discussions don't get bogged down in concern over turf, because I've talked with plenty of folks at a county level that feel like they're at a place where, you know, if everybody comes together in good faith, not trying to take duties or responsibilities or money away from this group just for the benefit of that group, but to have a sorting out and realignment, so to speak. I mean, there's a lot of people at all levels of government that would be willing to engage in those thoughtful discussions. So, thank you. Before we move on to the next testimony, Representative Berger, you look like you're poised to say
yes,
something.
Yes, I am. Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nathan. I'd love this hand engrossed, because otherwise I would never get through the and I was interested in who you envisions as staffing this, and I see that Governor, Secretary of State, Treasurer, Judiciary, Legislative, Fiscal, and County. I guess that's a big group. What's your vision here? Because you have to have lead staff on a group like this.
My vision for staffing is not well formed in detail. I will readily admit that. Yes, it's a lot of staffing. I am hoping that the task force will ultimately appoint subcommittees to work on particular areas, because the work can happen then concurrently rather than one at a time over time, and it could take 10 or 14 years to get through that list. And then the staffing, rather than being one set of staff reporting to the entire task force only, the staffing would get sorted out and work for particular subcommittees toward a particular effort, if that helps.
Yeah. Thank you. Follow up. I think I've been around too long. Okay, I think I'm getting jaded, because
I share your frustration
with these multiple layers of convoluted, you're pulling on a piece of string and all of a sudden something pops up over there and you go, well, how is that connected? And you're losing your mind. I'm a little concerned about this bill, because I think that's expensive staff, and a very, if you're actually going to get at any of this stuff, an incredibly vigorous work plan. We're not out of this building yet. So I guess while I really appreciate what you're trying to do, I see it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It's one of those that good idea can we afford it, and not just in terms of staff, but time. And so I'm wondering if at some point you might want to carve off a piece and instead of the whole pie, if I could suggest that. I think it's bigger than we even know.
I would be happy to consider that and work with the committee.
Thank you. Next.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, Mike MacArthur, Executive Director, Association of Oregon Counties. As a locally elected official, I used to introduce myself as the administrator of the State Department of County Services, Sherman County Branch, to point out our role in delivering plethora of services that Representative pointed out. We're incredibly grateful and appreciative to Representative Nathanson for bringing this idea forward. We think it's very timely. We've talked a lot in the years past about the systems approach. We've done the analysis of the breakdown of the revenues that go into some of these services with the 5520 project. We've done the Federal Forest Payments Task Force report, which, by the way, had no fiscal. This was done with existing folks, existing positions, other than the printing. So we think it's time for this work that is described in 2920 to be undertaken. The analogy I like to use is we're in the process probably of tearing down the house to the studs, and we don't have to rebuild it the same way. And I think this is the perfect time to look at how we restructure some of these fundamental services. And the Association of Counties and County Commissioners are fully engaged in that and want to take on that work. I see that there are a number of bills that are dealing with restructuring of certain services or investigating certain services or looking at regionalization. I would submit to you that I think this approach can encompass all of that. And I think it's a way to coordinate all those various interests that are in the building that would like to do some sort of restructuring. So I really think that we're onto something here, and I hope you'll support it.
Thank you. And are there any questions of the panel? Okay. Thank you very much. Next, we have John Charles. And is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2920? Is there anybody else here to testify on that today? Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles. I'm president of Cascade Policy Institute, a private nonpartisan research center based in Portland, and I'm here to support the bill for the reasons stated by previous witnesses. I do have a couple of friendly suggestions that follow somewhat from Representative Berger's comments. One is that the composition of the task force, even with the Dash 1 amendments, is comprised 100% of people who are employed by the government. And if you're trying to look at ways to do things more efficiently and the entire group are people who work for the government, there's a pretty good chance, I think, that you're going to overlook some ideas because you have people who are too close to the process. And so I don't want to overburden the group where it becomes too big, but I would suggest that you have room in there for some discretionary appointments of people from whatever walk of life, whatever background, who have a different perspective. Over my 30-year career in public policy, I've served on many of these task forces and commissions, and the best ones have been the ones with the most diverse makeup. Not only that, but at Cascade during the 1990s, four times over an 8-year period, we actually ran what we called a better government competition. And we simply solicited ideas, what we called it was sort of a statewide citizens suggestion box. And we offered cash prizes, not a lot of money, but you could, if you were one of the 10 winning concept papers in that particular year, you could get up to $3,000 by taking your concept and working it into a more detailed blueprint. And we would publish them. I actually have a couple copies. This is from 94 and 96. We published them in these booklets. These were the 10 winning papers from an outside independent judging group. And we distributed these widely. And I mean, it was, when you just open it up and say to everybody, we're looking for good ideas, it was amazing We had people, we had state and county employees who submitted ideas and were winners. We had retirees. We had farmland owners. I mean, it ran the entire gamut because we had hundreds of ideas submitted. So, and it didn't cost very much. Now, I'm not saying that you should run this committee that way. I'm just saying the more you open it up to a diverse group of folks, the more likely you're going to get interesting ideas. The second suggestion is that on page 2, line 13, where it talks about the task force shall submit a report and may include recommendations for legislation, I just say that if you want to move the bill, you might consider a little more carefully what you want in the report. Because all of us, either professionally or in our younger days as students, have actually had the task of sitting down to write reports. Well, what's going to be in the report? What do you actually want? I mean, for instance, do you want the task force to consider recommending a pilot project or two or three in some way to test an idea? And if so, what should that pilot project look like? There could be any number of other things that you're trying to elicit from the task force. The more specificity you give a group that starts and they're looking for momentum, the more you direct them and the more you direct a work product, the better the work product will be, I think. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anybody on the committee have any questions of Mr. Charles? Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks.
Anybody else? Last call for House Bill 2920. Okay. We're going to close public hearing on House Bill 2920 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2092.
Thank you, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. House Bill 2092 directs the State Archivist to provide assistance and training to political subdivisions concerning public records management, retention, long-term storage, and disposition. It adds a $1 fee for filing or recording by county clerks of any instrument described in ORS 205.130. Provides that one half of the fee is to be retained by counties in dedicated county archives fund, provides that one half of the fee is to be deposited in a public records management assistance fund established by the measure for the use of the state archivist, creates public records advisory committee to review grants established under the measure. You have a proposed amendment, -1, and the effect of that amendment, or what the proposed amendment states, is that it increases the proposed fee from $1 to $1.75 and reallocates the fee as follows. 50 cents of the fee to be deposited in dedicated county archive funds, 50 cents to be deposited in a public records management assistance fund established in HB 2092 for the use of state archivists, and 75% of the fee to be deposited in a county clerk's record fund. The proponents of HB 2092 assert that local governments in Oregon lack adequate funding to develop and maintain effective records management and archives program. The State Archives Division provides limited service and assistance on issues involving use, access, and retention of public records. Proponents of HB 2092 assert that there is greater need than current local or state resources provide. Recording and filing fees are charged and collected under ORS 205.320, 205.325, and elsewhere in Oregon law. ORS 205.323 currently provides for two fees in the total combined amount of $11 to be collected when documents are filed and recorded. HB 2092 amends that provision to add a $1 fee to documents recorded by county clerks, with the fee to be split equally between county clerks and state archive divisions. As I've stated previously, the amendment would change that if it were to be adopted. Proponents assert that the fee would allow additional archives division staff to be assigned to work with counties and cities on records management and or a regranting program in which fees collected would be awarded as grants to local governments to develop archives and record management programs at the local level. Proponents also assert that similar programs have been successfully established in Washington State, New York, and New Jersey, and provide documentation that 12 to 16 states have established some form of fee structure to support local government records management. That's my report.
Thank you, Jerry. First, we will call up, going down the list here, Jan Coleman and Georgette Brown, Oregon Association of County Clerks. Is that?
I think you might call.
Actually, hold on just a second. Just a second. Let's get the Secretary of State's office up here first. So Mary Beth Herkert. You wrote it all out for me. I just ignored it anyway.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Herkert, and I'm the director of the Secretary of State's Archives Division, and I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 2092. The Archives Division is charged with acquiring the permanently valuable records of the state, providing access to records, and ensuring their physical care. In addition, we are required to provide advice and assistance to all state and local government entities on all records issues from the time that that record is created until its final disposition. These services are provided to over 3,000 government entities and include writing and authorizing records retention schedules, providing workshops and training on a variety of records issues, such as electronic records, email, disaster preparedness and recovery, and how to store and manage information until the authorized retention has been met, providing phone and in-person assistance and in writing. Administrative rules and standards relating to technology and records processes. For example, we have done over 100 trainings in basic records management in the 2007-2009 biennium, and while this two-hour-long training is very helpful, its value diminishes without proper follow-up. At many of these workshops, we agree to next steps, such as writing and reviewing policies and procedures, but due to the lack of resources, follow-through is often difficult, leaving counties, cities, and special districts vulnerable and their public records at risk. In addition, many local governments struggle with the costs associated with protecting, managing, and maintaining the information created by their jurisdiction, and often have only one person designated to do this task: the county clerk, the city recorder, and the special district's records officer not only are responsible for the information that they create, but for their entire jurisdiction as well. Many have struggled with paper records management and access, and do not know where to begin, or are having trouble knowing where to begin with electronic records management information that is public record. Storage areas at the local level often consist of areas beneath stairwells, in bathrooms, jail cells, and public works garages. Oregon City, for example, stores its paper records in two semi-tractor trailer containers that sit in the City Hall parking lot. Water damage, excessive temperature and humidity swings, and vermin threaten our public records because of these types of storage facilities. These storage problems, in turn, create access issues in locating a record requested by a member of the public, press, or other government entity, and may take days to respond to, as a member of the staff has to first determine which area the particular record is stored in, and then hunt to find the particular box or file which contains the requested information. The bill before you would significantly help us through these challenges by providing a dedicated financial resource for local government public records assistance. The process would work as follows. In the course of acquiring documents filed with the county clerk, we are asking that an additional dollar fee be charged per filing to aid in the course of protecting and providing access to records at the county, city, and special district levels. The $1 fee is structured to keep, and this is the original, before the amendment, is to keep 50% of the monies collected in a dedicated fund at the county where the fees are collected, and that the other 50% go into a dedicated fund at the state archives that will be used to staff one position and the remainder re-granted to all local government entities for the sole purpose of managing and maintaining public records. The bill also provides for the creation of a local government committee consisting of two county clerks, one city recorder, and one special district records officer, and the state archivist, to review the grant proposals and award the the approximately $1 million collected by the records-related projects. These projects could be as simple as buying proper archive boxes, to buying shelving for storage areas, to purchasing electronic records management software to better provide access and management for electronic records. As a state fulfilling its duty to its citizens, the care of a 100-year-old marriage record in Lake County is as important as providing access to building plans for a subdivision in Coos Bay or to the minutes of the county commissioners meeting in Marion County. These records should be equally accessible and equally protected. This bill would make a significant impact in our ability to do this. And I am happy to answer any questions that you may have at this time.
Thank you. Anybody have any questions? I have a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had a chance to review the dash ones? You mentioned the dollar filing fee, the dash ones, say, move it to $1.75 and reallocate how that's split out. Have you guys had a chance to look at those, and are you supportive or not? Or
Chair Edwards, yes, we are. We've looked at them, and we are very supportive of it.
Okay. Anything? Okay. Thank you very much. Next, I'm going to skip around again from what I first started to call up, and I'm going to call up now Karen Lieberton-Coates from Wasco County, Nancy Ide and Lori Boyce. Are they here?
No. Are they on here?
Yeah, Lori, is Lori Boyce here?
Yes.
And it doesn't look like they've signed up. Nancy. Yeah, it doesn't look like they're here. Okay. You're on.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Lori Boyce, and I'm the city recorder for Aurora, Oregon. I'd like to go on record in support of House Bill 2092 and the creation of the Public Records Management Assistance Fund. The creation of the fund would provide needed assistance to cities in the form of provide assistance and training in records management to all local government officials, whether elected or appointed. Provide advice to all local governments concerning the proper methods of creating, maintaining, cataloging, indexing, transmitting, storing, and reproducing. Grant awards for programs relating to public records management and employing staff dedicated to assisting local governments with records management. The City of Aurora would greatly benefit from such assistance. Like most small cities, we are struggling to keep up with the day-to-day operational things that must get done. However, shrinking funds and increasing demands require our valuable general fund dollars. Records management kind of items that are needed to preserve the City of Aurora's records do get cut from the shrinking budget. As the custodian of the records, I want to ensure that our documents are available and preserved, not only for the citizens and staff that I would work for, but for future generations as well. Obviously, a grant that could help us purchase such items would be invaluable. I am the co-chair of the Records Management Committee this year, and I do work closely with the State Archives Records Management Department. We have collaborated in the preparation of the city's general records retention schedule and presented training opportunities and instruction manuals for cities throughout Oregon. When I first started out as a city recorder, I was not familiar with the subject of records management. With assistance and advice from a knowledgeable source is valuable. Also working with small staff of the State Archives Division, we know firsthand of their limitations to travel throughout the state to provide assistance, advice, and training to cities. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of Ms. Boyce? Thanks for coming. Next, we'll call up. Okay. We'll go up to Georgette Brown and Jan Coleman from the clerks.
I'm going to join them too on Ann Hannah.
Please.
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, I'm Jan Coleman. I'm representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks today. I want to speak to the bill. First, we'd like to put on record our thanks to Representative Roblin for his amendment. But even regardless of that, we think the bill deserves support as it stands. There's probably no better bill out there that attaches to recording than this one could be, because it actually is supporting the recording function and so forth. Every time a document is recorded, we create a public record that must be maintained. I've given you a little tracking here of what it costs to record a document. We had one county clerk who had a little study and had her staff tracked, and they came out to find that it cost in that county about $23.79 just to record a document. That's just the employee part. When we record the fees we get today, there is a $5 per page fee on recording, but we want you to understand that that fee goes into the general fund. So that not necessarily does it come back to the county clerk. Anytime it goes into the general fund, it can be used for other departments as well. Anybody who is supported by the general fund. The actual fees that the clerk gets, we get a 50-cent fee off the $10 portion of the A&T fee. And we also can get up to 50 cents off of a land corner fee, but that varies by county. It can go from nothing in some counties up to $10. So that can be up to 50 cents. Those are dedicated fees. They go into the county clerk records fund, which is defined there in 205-320-18. That specific part, if we collect a fee for another entity that is not part of the actual fee on recording, the clerk gets 5% that goes into the county clerk records fund.
Jan, could you hold on for just a minute? I think Representative Gelser has a question.
Yes, thank you. Can you clarify for me, is there a difference between the page and the document? So can a single document have many pages, and then are you receiving $5 for each page? So a five-page document would be, or the county general fund would be, a $25
fee. That's correct.
And the cost of processing, where you say the $23.79, that's not per page, that's per document, which could be many pages.
Right. Right.
Okay.
And that's an average.
Okay. Uh-huh. Thank you.
That's what they came out with. And there can, documents vary hugely. It can be one page. In fact, a majority of documents probably are one page. But then you get some trustees that in themselves are almost 100 pages. They're huge. So it varies.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, 205-130 also establishes the county clerk as the archivist for the county. That's also supported in the Oregon Constitution. In public records law 192 and administrative rules from the State Archive Division, who directs us with all the keeping of all our public records, all the time periods that those various records need to be kept, and also time periods for when they need to be destroyed. And part of their education they give us is telling us how important it is to destroy documents timely, too. That's all part of our education. Anyway, clerks are really concerned with preserving the integrity of the record. We have permanent records that go back to our county's times. I came from Yamhill County. Mine started in 1854. So those are all part of our public records that we're working to maintain. We have old books. We have electronic records. We have all sorts of things. And in this day and age, where all counties are facing crisis, just as the state is, for budgeting, and we are finding that what is happening, even though this clerk of records fund takes a long time to accumulate some monies, many of the counties are being expected more and more to operate their offices from this fund with very little help from any general fund monies. Anyway, the clerks are very much in support of this bill. It would help us do things that we haven't been able to do for years. I have to tell you, this was kind of an orphan child in my office. We did it as we could work it in. And it would be great to have more help in doing this, particularly with planning for disaster situations and so forth. This is really important with all of your permanent records.
Thank you, Jan. Georgette, or?
I'll be brief. I do agree with Jan that the county clerks completely support this bill. And I just want to say that this bill is very much connected to recording, because it has to do with archives, which all our records are in our archives, and we get direction, we get help and everything from archives. Contrary to other fees, which we are taxes, which we are having to collect now for, like, the assessment of taxation or low-cost housing, those are fees that are not directly recording fees, whereas this archives bill actually relates to recording and the retention of records.
Please.
Thanks. Well, in honor of the start of spring break, I'll keep my testimony really short. Counties are facing tough times. You heard that from...
Your name for the record.
Oh, Ann Hannes, Association of Oregon Counties. You heard from Mike MacArthur and Representative Nathanson. Counties are facing very tough times. We very much support this amendment that would generate much-needed revenue to support the financial viability of the clerks. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll ask a very quick question. I'm assuming the answer is going to be fairly concise. We passed a bill earlier this session that related to document recording fees. Are we talking about the same documents and the same fee that you're proposing that this be added on top of? Same sets of documents that we're talking about. Is that correct?
Are you talking about the low-cost housing?
Yes.
One? Yes, except that fee has exceptions. It's not on every single recording. There are certain exceptions that are pointed out in the statute, so it would not be on every single one. Some of the liens, some of the revenue liens, some of the things are accepted on the housing bill. But on that housing bill of $15 for housing, we did not get the 5%.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else from the committee for the panel? Thank you very much for coming and testifying.
Thank you.
Moving down the list, we have next Erica Hagedorn and Jana Jarvis. Fire away.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Erica Hagedorn here today on behalf of the Housing Alliance. First of all, we'd like to say thank you very much. Everybody present here supported the document recording fee for affordable housing, which is truly going to make a difference, especially in this economy, to put a roof over the heads of many needy Oregonians. So we appreciate that. The part of the genesis for the document recording fee was 18 months of negotiations with a group of folks who were traditionally our staunch foes in this discussion, the home builders, realtors, and bankers. Over the interim between the 2007 session and this session, we talked a lot with these groups about the balance between an appropriate recording fee and the need for affordable housing. What we came up with was the $15 fee, which we feel strikes the correct balance between what people are willing and able to pay and the need for affordable housing in this state. Part of this historic agreement was in exchange for the support of our industry partners for the document recording fee, we would also agree to oppose any other document recording fee this session, which is why a few of you have seen me in front of other committees singing this exact same song, just in a different place. So what we'd like you to consider today is the document recording fee that you passed already, we feel was the appropriate balance between what people are willing and able to pay and the needs in front of us for affordable housing. So we would respectfully oppose this bill and any other bill that would increase document recording fees on Oregonians.
Thank you, Erica. Jana.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jana Jarvis, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. You might question the wisdom of some of my compatriots because I'm also here today speaking on behalf of the home builders, the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, and the Oregon Bankers. This time on a Friday afternoon, I apparently drew the short straw. But I do want, I am here to speak in opposition, and I want you to remember
we
that
all did.
In the future. No, I am here to speak in opposition to House Bill 2092, not because we're not sympathetic to the needs of the cities and the archive needs, but because the collaborative effort that we put forth in this interim and the results of that will be put in jeopardy in future sessions. We did feel very strongly that $15 was a large fee, that the cost of adding that to the documents, anything over that, would put our arrangement in jeopardy. And then it appears this session, because you've seen us already a couple of times, and I think there are a couple of other bills as well, that this has become sort of the tax du jour, that increases to the document recording fee. There are several proposals this particular legislative session. So that concerns me. And it's concerned me that that seems to be everyone's answer to revenue increases. I think that the question was asked whether these were the same documents, Mr. Chair. My understanding is they're same real estate-related documents. The exceptions that were referred to were rather minimal in the bill that we passed earlier this session. So with that in mind, I just want you to know that we are here in opposition to House Bill 2092 and ask, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, both of you. Does anybody on the committee have any questions? Doesn't look like it. I can assure you that when the House Revenue Committee is done for the session, that this will no longer look like the revenue du jour. Representative Reed.
I wonder just if Ms. Jarvis suggested that her presence here is related to her drawing the short stick, what she thinks about our presence here.
Well, I wanted the same thing, Representative.
No insult.
Okay.
Thank you
both. And final sign up on the list is Tom Quintal. Has anybody else signed up to testify on House Bill 2092? Or not signed up, I guess, but is here for that. Okay.
Put that down. I guess I get to advertise.
Okay.
My name is Tom Quintal. First, I should say Vice Chair Edwards and members of the committee. My name is Tom Quintal. I live in Salem. Small-scale miner. In contact with over 5,000 miners in Oregon. And we really have some real serious concerns of what's going on with the county clerks having to collect so much money for so many different causes. And I'll cover some of those in just a second. I don't know how I want to be on this bill, whether I want to support it or be neutral, because right now we're in conflict with legislative council on our amendment that we tried to enter. And I just got off the phone before I came down here with Becky over at Yamhill County Clerks, and her staff researched whether or not we fall under this relating clause that's in the bill. And because it's a matter of public record, she says, yes, you come under deeds and mortgages. So you're in that, no matter how you look at it. And where we're at in that is Section 8, ORS 205-320, subsection 4. That's paragraph 16, or section 16. So I need to get back with Dexter Johnson in Legislative Council and have him talk with their staff and find out why our amendment cannot be entered in here in this bill. Now, what bothers me so much is that with that relating clause, obviously, it eliminates at this time from us putting that amendment in. And, you say it's only a dollar. Well, I'll come to that in just a second. The legislature mandate all miners that have mining claims that they shall, under ORS 517-210, record an annual proof of labor annually, or they'll lose their mineral property, and that's just like you owning your home. It's a property. And so we think it's unfair. The legislature is saying you will do this, or you will lose your property. And, it seems to me if you're forced to do something, then you should be able to be exempt from it. Now, we're not asking to be exempt from all mining documents for recording, and we're not asked to be exempt from recording the current fee on the annual proof of labor at the clerk's office. We're not asking for an exemption on that either. We're only asking for an exemption for the new fee. And as some has already mentioned, this legislative session is passed 2436. We did get our amendment in that bill. That's a $15 increase. However, on all of our other mining documents, we will be paying the $15, which will be about $41 now, depending on the county that these documents are recorded in. So any notice of locations, new notice of locations, amendment notices, quick claim deeds, on and on it goes, we pay that full fee. And that's a choice we have. If we want to come up with a new claim and we choose to do that, that's our choice. But here, we don't have a choice. Either we file it or we lose our claim and it's open for relocation for some other person. And we've been getting some pretty good sympathy around the committees on this very thing because they can understand why we're concerned about these increases. Now, we've got House Bill 2071. I attended a hearing on that, and they want $9 again increase to record per document. You've got House Bill 2844. They're requesting a $6 increase for recording fees per document. So I guess what I have some, and not me, but 5,000 others of us out there have some concerns that the clerks basically have been hijacked as tax collectors. And, they still only get $5 to record a document. They get that. And any $5 additional and so forth. So that's the fee we should be paying for. We're in a depressed economy right now, and I just can't imagine that we want to keep hammering on people for, you can call it a fee, call it a tax. Now, we're already paying, and if you look at the back of the information I gave you there, we're already paying BLM, Bureau of Land Management, recording fees and maintenance fees annually. And some of those fees range from $135, and then we still pay the recording fee on top of that at the clerk's office. Now, I gave you an example of the LR2000 system. It's a duplicative service, and we're still paying for it. BLM retains their documents in the regional offices for 2 years, up to 2 years on a closed claim. And then, if there's no action by that individual that owns that claim, it goes to Seattle. It's retained up there for 50 years in the archives. So we've already got archiving. Any citizen, anyone can get a copy of it. It's open public record. So, I don't know. I guess I should say I'm opposed to it. If we can put in the affidavit exception, I might be interested in saying, well, it's just one more service, I guess. But I don't know. It's just getting really too much. So I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Broder.
Yeah, thank you for coming down, Mr. Quinto. Do you have to, what happens if your claim is not on BLM property?
If it's on state land, it becomes a lease from the state. In other words, and I don't know many of those, a county either. There are some county properties as well. And that's a lease arrangement within the minor and the county.
So it would not be recorded on the BLM archive?
That one probably not, I would guess.
I just was thinking, yeah. You know, there may be part of Oregon that the BLM doesn't control.
Yeah.
Just maybe a little bit.
I just don't think that...
But it doesn't seem like that sometimes.
Yeah.
Thank you. I just...
You bet.
Curious about that.
Well, thank you. So would it be safe to summarize your position on this bill is that you folks need the services and aren't so opposed to paying for those services, but on top of the $15 document recording fee for affordable housing, which you don't necessarily assume there's a very good nexus between that and the type of documents you have to record, on top of that, you feel like you have to be opposed because it's just that much more. Is that a fair summary?
When you say,
or am I understanding?
Am I opposed to the service? We don't need the service. It's a duplicate. That's all it is for us. So, yeah, I oppose it from that standpoint.
Okay.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, my memory from Revenue Committee was that mining claims were exempt.
From tax, yes, they are.
Okay,
They sure are. And I think I don't know if I included that statute in my testimony.
Okay.
But there's also a federal statute that says mining claims should be free and open for purchase. Mm-hmm. And that can be interpreted a lot of different ways. But, yeah, there is an ORA statute that exempts the mining claim from taxation. I don't think I put it in this one here.
Okay.
But then you have to make the distinction, is it a tax, is it a fee for service? And there's where the issue comes in. You know, I've had some really interesting conversations with legislative council this year with respect to, is it a fee or is it a tax? And on 2436, we had some really concerns about that. And we talked to our attorney about it, and he says, well, it's a tax. It's a tax. And I said, well, then how are they getting away with it? And they said, well, you go talk to legislative council and find out. I did. I talked to Dexter Johnson here last week, and he said, well, here's how we do that. We put it in here like this. We put it has to pass with 3/5 majority. We put that in there. That's their escape clause. He said, yes, it's a tax, but it's an escape clause that they don't have to worry about it. Legislative council, they put it on the legislative body to make a 3/5 majority to pass it, and then he says, you can call it anything you want. I went, whoa, this is really getting interesting. I can't believe that, but that's what's going on. So,
Any other questions for Tom? Thank you for...
You betcha. Thank
for
you.
Coming to Salem.
I think he lives here.
So we're going to...
I think he lives here.
Oh, you live here. I'm sorry. Thanks for coming to the Capitol. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2092, and we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 323. And staff will read the measure summary.
Thank you, Chair Edwards. Senate Bill 323 allows persons required to submit written reports to the Legislative Assembly to do so through posting an electronic form of report on the Internet and providing an online location in a written summary. It requires distribution of a physical copy of the executive summary to each legislator, the offices of presiding officers, and legislative administrator. It declares an emergency effective upon passage. This measure is part of legislative leaders' stated goal to reduce the Capitol's carbon footprint. Rather than delivering physical copies of reports due to the Legislative Assembly, ORS 192.425 currently requires that an executive summary of no more than 2 pages be submitted to each legislator and a total of 7 copies of the full report be sent to the office of presiding officers, 1 copy each, and the legislative administrator, 5 copies. Senate Bill 323 would allow for the required executive summaries of report to reference an online location to review reports in their entirety. Issues discussed during consideration of this measure by the Senate Committee on Education and General Government included the current requirement to provide hard copies of reports, the distribution of executive summaries, and additional opportunities to reduce the use of paper.
Thank you. And Sasha Pollack, would you kick us off here?
Absolutely. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Sasha Pollack. I work for Senate President Peter Courtney. Thank you for hearing testimony. The Senate President apologizes. He, of course, would like to be here testifying in front of you today, but has sent me instead.
Hold on.
I'm sorry, Sasha, but please express to the Senate President that at 4:10 on a Friday afternoon, we really miss him.
We knew that was coming.
Chair Edwards, Representative Berger, to be clear, he is in a meeting in the building.
I'm sure. Just pass it on.
I will indeed. Before me, you can see just one of the dozens of reports that are sent to the presiding officers every year. I have a visual aid of a Safe Corporation report. It is in excess of... They don't even have page numbers in it. It's so long. But there are many of these reports that are given to the presiding officers every year, every 2 years. Senate Bill 323 would, while still allowing these to be printed at the request of any member, as they are currently, would only give the executive summary and direct the presiding officers as well as the other members of the legislature to an online report. I'm happy to answer any questions. It's a pretty straightforward bill.
It is straightforward, and it's a great bill. It drives me nuts, the number of reports. I started stacking them up this summer, and I finally ran out of room and pitched them all in the recycle bin, but I was going to do a remonstrance at some point during the session and stack them all on my desk. And I can tell you, I can count on one hand the number of them that I read.
Do you want to know my method? When I get one of those, I have this certain closet, and it's only so big, and I start filling it, and when it gets full at this end, I pull them out at that end and chuck them. So that I always have the most recent one in the closet, but I'm only going to devote X number of inches of space to those unread documents.
And it is important that we have access. There are some, like Representative Nathanson brought up, and I brought my copy of the Governor's Task Force on Federal Forest Payments County Services. I'm reading this one right now, and it is important that we have access to those reports, but it's a little bit excessive, the amount of cost and paper that's used and space that it takes up. So, Representative Reed.
Thank you. To your point, I've also found it considerably easier to access and use the information when it's electronic, much easier to search, much easier to find. Where was that report I got from so-and-so on such-and-such? So I'm also a fan of the approach. I'm glad we're doing it.
And I am now electronic in my filing system, and I admit to getting used to reading online. But I will tell you that under this, I like getting executive summaries, and anything that I really want to read, I have to download to get serious about. But this method allows me the opportunity to say, this is something I need to know more, and download or go somewhere else to find out more. I appreciate this approach.
Chair Edwards, Representative Berger, yes, and one of the things that we're excited about, and as I can see, you all have your laptops here, so it's obvious that we as a legislature have really distinctly made the move towards the electronic format. You can choose to download and print only a certain number of pages out of a report or a certain graph or chart instead of the entire report.
Any other questions for Sasha? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Which visual aid did you use? I didn't
this
quite see which
the,
one.
This is the actuarial valuations as of December 31st, 2007 for the Safe Corporation, and their two addendums, the financial statements for the year.
Fabulous. Thank you.
This is the executive summary.
That's probably all you need to know. Okay. Well, thank you very much. We're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 323, And we are going to open a hearing on the last bill of the day, which is, as soon as I find it, Senate Bill 75. And staff will read the measure summary.
Thank you, Chair Edwards, members of the committee. The bill before you is Senate Bill 75A. 75A establishes a procedure for the governor to voluntarily transfer duties of office to the acting governor when the governor expects to be temporarily unable to discharge the duties of the office. It also establishes a 5-member disability evaluation panel, establishes qualifications of and procedures for designating panel members, requires a disability panel evaluation panel to be convoked upon written request of at least 2 specified state officials, establishes a procedure for the disability evaluation panel to find that the governor is unable to discharge the duties of the office or is able to resume duties of the office, and repeals current statutes on disability of the governor. During a recent emergency preparedness exercise, the governor reported a contrived disability that caused officials to examine current gubernatorial succession and disability statutes. It was determined that under current statutes, significant difficulties and logistical problems could arise and prevent a gubernatorial vacancy from being filled. Senate Bill 75A is a proposal to remedy the problems that were identified.
Thank you. We have one person signed up to testify. Paul.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's unusual that the members of the committee outnumber the members in the audience, but I want to thank you for sticking
Mr.
with
Chair,
it.
Mr. Chair, but I have to comment. I'm sure there are oceans of people out in TV land who are rapt on our every word.
Not to mention, Representative, the Internet as well.
The what?
The Internet. Surely they're
surely
listening to the audio.
Surely.
Representative Berger duly noted. For the record, Paul Evans, and for those in TV land, Paul Evans, policy advisor, Governor Kulongoski for Military, Emergency, and Veterans Affairs. And I will remember that there are many more people watching than the folks that are here, although these folks here are much more fun. As was stated, Senate Bill 75 comes out of the experience that we had with Top Off 4, which was, at the time, the largest homeland security exercise in American history. The governor, when looking at that exercise, decided that there was a little-known piece of governance that had not been tested since it had been put into place, having to do with the succession of a governor. And it was an add-on exercise that actually provided not a little bit of anxiety and excitement in the exercise as a whole, because no other state that was involved knew that we were exercising this. And in fact, the virtual news network reported that our governor had in fact had a problem, which then became part of the exercise. So nonetheless, it actually did exercise the entire process. And what we learned as a result was that in the current statute, if the governor appears to be sick or unable to perform his duties, a 3-member panel of the Chief Justice, the the Health Sciences University Dean of the Med School, as well as the State Hospital Director, are the convening panel. In this particular case, it was the Chief Justice, an ear, nose, and throat specialist, and a psychiatrist, trying to determine whether or not the governor's heart attack simulated was a simulated heart attack. That proved that several things were interesting. Number one, that while there was probably a reason for the bill, for the way it was written, it didn't really guarantee specialists that could actually perform the function of evaluating whether a governor is healthy or not. Number two, the secret ballot process that currently is in place actually provides for at least a limited level of skullduggery if somebody wanted to, because all three have to unanimously agree in secret for a governor to return to power. And a number of folks recognize that there was potential for harms there. Senate Bill 75, we believe, is the best solution to the problem. It is a rational way to approach the succession. It involves 5 panelists, and it provides for the ability to designate specialists if necessary. It also provides a little more flexibility in terms of
We recognize that there was nothing really concrete about a voluntary transition of authority for, say, a surgery or something like that. So this actually provides that vehicle as well. It also recognizes that in certain cases, geography may be challenged by the nature of the disaster that may have encumbered the governor. So the governor's office believes this represents the best policy for Oregon in terms of a succession act. And as we've learned through disasters over the last 5 to 7 years, certainty of command and control and the ability to function during times of crisis is important. So we hope that you have an opportunity to explore the bill, and if there's any questions, I might try to answer.
Representative Broder?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, you know, for all the lateness of the day and how tired we are, this could be, as you well know.
Yes, ma'am.
We better get it right, because when we need it, we're going to need it in a hurry, and we're going to need it to work. Tell me exactly how it would work, if you could go through this bill a little bit, its provisions, and what would be. And also, if I could further ask, where did this come from? Has it been used in other venues? Is this the recommendation of federal policymakers or somebody else, security people? And third, if we do this, is there any federal money in it? That was a joke.
Maybe not really. Chair Edwards, Representative Berger, I'll try to take the questions one at a time. One is exploring the function and how it would work. Two is, I can't remember what two was. Three was no federal
funds.
Where
did you get this idea? I mean, have security people, has this been worked in other states? Is this a recommendation? I mean, or did you just make it up and think this sounded like a good idea, which I know you didn't do?
Well, I'm not above that, Representative Berger. however, in this particular case, what we try to do, I'm going to answer your second point and then work you through the
yeah.
process. The second point is we took what currently is in existence, that there is a panel of folks that could evaluate, and we tried to basically build with what was precedent and also try to make it more applicable to real-world scenarios. Under Section 2, it gives some flexibility in terms of who is comprised of that convocation panel so that it actually provides the flexibility necessary for most circumstances. After 20 years in government, I can probably assure you this is not a perfect bill, but we think it is an improvement to what's there. Again, trying to make sure we don't have a situation where there is secret ballots and, or at least secret unanimous ballots, and only three people of which none of which may be able to determine whether or not the health condition involved in the involuntary succession is involved. So it was not made up out of whole cloth. It really was an adjustment, an amendment to the existing structure. There is a recognition that because we do not have a lieutenant governor per se, we wanted to make sure that we had a rational process as possible with the current succession line that we have in place. The other piece was that there had been for some time discussion about the need for a voluntary ability for a governor to step away from that responsibility, and it's very similar to the presidential act, and which is common in most states, that under certain circumstances, chief executive can hand authority over and then receive it back. And that was one of the concerns. The existing law actually, even if the governor wants it back, unless those three people agree, doesn't come back, which we believe, again, is not a good policy because, well, we hope that everybody has good intentions going into the game. If one person had a particular issue with the governor, regardless of their ability or capacity to perform the mission, private vendettas could actually get in the way of the public will. So bottom line is we did not make it up out of whole cloth. It's an adjustment and amendment to what it currently exists. How it would work, and I saw you want to come up here part of this?
I was just here in case there were
questions.
You want to come on forward and
Kelly Sky,
and,
the
and
legal counsel,
Kelly
come up here
and help,
and
poke help
me
pull
where
out here.
Wrong. But basically, this is a situation, and we're going to kind of play with scenarios. Scenario one. Governor has a surgery that's going to last some time that has some risk in it. He or she can designate the time that the authority will go from the governor to Secretary of State. And the five-member panel some of which are by position, such as the Chief Justice, some of which are by designation by the governor, and some of which are by designation by key instruments like the Department of Human Services director, would be ready to evaluate when the governor was ready to come back from authority, as I understand it.
You're talking about the voluntary transfer?
The voluntary transfer.
What? Sorry. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, Kelly Skye, I'm legal counsel to Governor Kulongoski, and I actually drafted the bill, which is why I came down when I saw that Paul was testifying on it. The anticipated, the voluntary transfer of duties is actually anticipated to be a start date and an end date set by the governor. So if he were going to have surgery and he wanted to say to the Secretary of State, I would like you to take the authority until I return, and then he decides when he wants to return. He can set that date in advance or he can contact later. But he is obligated to follow the lines of succession that are outlined in the Constitution, and nothing in this bill would affect the constitutional provisions at all.
Under an involuntary situation, this actually, the amended version is slightly different than what we had first had. In Section 3, it lists Secretary of State, State Treasurer, President of the Senate, Speaker of the House, Chief of Staff, or the Governor. Two of those five have to agree to bring people together to determine whether or not the Governor is able to do the job or not. It was mentioned in the Senate discussion that having only one person of that group suggest that might actually, again, lead to some conversations that would be somewhat frustrating and potentially not helpful. That if two of the five could agree that there was at least the possibility of a problem, that would be a more rational standard. Again, walking through the process, the governor is involuntarily incapacitated. What would happen is the five members of the convocation panel would be brought together. If we could, if not, then under certain circumstances, standards could be done because of a geographic concern or something like that. And then they would actually evaluate whether or not the governor is capable of doing the job. At the time that the governor believes he or she is ready, then the panel would come together and provide an evaluation as to whether they can return or not. That's kind of how I think it would work.
Could you walk us through who the five people are on the panel?
Sure. Under Section 2, it says the first member is the Chief Justice of the Oregon State Supreme Court, or I believe it can actually be another judge if he is unavailable, correct?
Yes.
The Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals.
Correct.
A second member would be a judge serving on the Oregon Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals designated by the governor. Okay, so two judges. Third is a person that is a licensed physician under ORS Chapter 677 designated by the dean of the Oregon Health Sciences University. That gets around that one problem that we had in terms of the dean may or may not have the skills necessary to evaluate the kind of condition that the governor has. Next person is a person who is licensed as a physician under ORS Chapter 677 that is designated by the Director of Human Services. That also was trying to get around the small problem we had with the director of the state hospital that's under current statute that in this case was a psychiatrist and couldn't really do a whole lot to help with a heart attack. And then the last person, five, it basically just by designation, right?
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, the fifth person is a physician that's pre-designated by the governor. So he gets to choose a personal physician, and he will designate that person when he takes office, file that with the Secretary of State along with his designation of judge.
Representative Berger.
So if I understand it, it's two judges and three physicians.
Right.
And if I read the bill, and I'm trying to read it online, I'm not real quick on that, it also indicates that each of those people can have, there are alternatives on file in case somebody,
right,
one of the designated people is not available, so they would go to the next alternate,
right,
in each of those cases.
Yeah.
And what's the other thing? I was going to comment, if you indulge me, that it's a good thing we're getting this head of the state hospital, because the current head of the state hospital is not a physician. It's a hospital administrator, hardly the person that would have expertise in this area.
Chair Edwards, Representative Berger, I absolutely agree that when we were researching this, especially after the incident, it appeared that the solution that's currently in statute was a political answer as opposed to a a good policy answer. And we wanted to make sure that, while we didn't ignore what currently exists, we built more flexibility to make sure that it actually provides a system that can determine whether or not a governor is fit for service. Because, as you discussed a few minutes ago, this is an important enough call that we want to make sure and get it right the first time. Because likely, I mean, a scenario that is not uncommon is that during a crisis event is when somebody under immense stress could have a situation. And that is not when you want to try to figure out who's in charge. We've had a number of examples in history where that's the wrong answer.
Any other questions?
No.
Thank you very much. I did wonder when I saw the word OHSU. It did cross my mind. I wondered if Representative Labor was going to be on the panel. Just kidding. Given a bill that we just passed this last week. And I was wondering if we could get the governor down here to reenact his contrived disability for us, but I don't think that'll probably be happening
Chair
either.
Edwards, members of the committee, just for 1 minute of indulgence, I have to tell you, again, in 20 years of government, I've done lots of different types of scenarios, especially in the military. And we had planned this and set this up and queued this up. And we knew that the governor was going to be working through this process. I did not know how good of an actor he was. And as we sat in the mock governor's office in this disaster scenario, there were more than two or three policy advisors concerned that the governor, in fact, was having a small crisis at that time, to which we were questioning, well, this process isn't, are we actually taking authority away from the governor at this point? And the Chief Justice, God bless his soul, looked at the governor as the governor was working through this scenario, looked at us like, do you really want me to continue or not? Because this may be actually a problem. And lo and behold, everything worked out. But boy, there were a few minutes where we were, the governor's very good at what he does. Let's just say that.
Well, thank you both for being here. Any other questions from the committee of the panel? Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else in the room here to testify on Senate Bill 75A? Seeing none, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 75A, and we are adjourned.